In a world where tropes run rampant, two men stand tall. Well, one not so tall. They are ready. They are steadfast. They are making it up as they go along. They are the Trope Stormers.
Hello and welcome to Trope Stormers, tackling tropes in movies, TV, video games and more. I'm Jim Carlberg, your host, and I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Chris Jeeves. How are you doing, mate?
I'm good, thanks, man. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you. So, we are the titular Trope Stormers.
That's what we are.
But what does that mean, Chris?
That's a very good question, Jim. I'm glad you asked.
Firstly, we've got to establish what a trope is.
Mm.
For this podcast, we're having a nice drink.
We are having a nice drink.
What are we drinking today?
Tonight, Jim, we are mostly drinking BrewDog's Dead Pony Club. A nice session IPA.
Wonderful, wonderful. A lovely session IPA. It's gone down very nicely in preparation for this podcast. And it's called Dead Pony, which links very nicely to tropes.
Quite the segue.
So, dead horse tropes are bad tropes.
Okay.
But tropes are a force for good as well, right?
They can be.
So,
used responsibly.
Used responsibly, much like Dead Pony. Used responsibly, they can be a good thing. Mm. So, tropes are devices.
Yes.
And they are ways in which a author or a writer or a filmmaker...
Well, they're kind of... They're a plot device, really, aren't they? Originally, there's thought to be seven different story narratives coming from, I think, ancient Greek times. There's kind of seven different routes that a story could ultimately take. They kind of form the backbone of most sort of generic story types. And tropes can be good, like you say, or they can be bad. They can be a force of good or a force of evil. And quite often in like literary devices or for film purposes or on screen or whatever, they can be used to help move a story along, give it direction, keep the whole flow of everything running together. But at their worst, I think they can be used lazily or lacking in imagination and creativity from the writers, trying to sort of tie together some loose threads or rather ham-fistedly shoehorn some bits together, which probably shouldn't really go. Yeah, so tropes can be good and can be bad.
Yeah, so for example, I mean, we're big lovers of video games.
Yes.
Things like the Super Mario series.
Much indeed. Yeah, so that's like Damsel in Distress, Princess Peach needing to be rescued by Mario. Story as old as time, you know, overweight Italian plumber meets girl, princess of the Mushroom Kingdom, needs rescuing.
Eats magic mushrooms. Grows 20 feet tall.
Fires fireballs.
Yeah.
Fights giant lizard.
So it gets round it in other ways.
Yeah.
But it is a trope that's really common and it borders on cliche.
Yes.
What we're going to do with this podcast is we're aiming to look at films that we like and films that we don't like as well, sometimes, and look at them and try and assess whether what they're doing is right in terms of tropes, in terms of the story beats, in terms of working out how well they work as a piece of art.
In our humble opinion.
In our humble opinion. We are the titular Trope Stormers and we are trying to assess whether they are in utopia or dystropia.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, thank
I like
you very
that
much.
A lot.
So, because in this age where everything's binary, you know,
or non-binary.
Or non-binary.
We're inclusive.
But, so in this age where everything is either good or terrible, what we've got to assess at the end of this process is whether something is really, really good in terms of the tropes that they use or something is really, really bad.
So we are the antithesis of Christian Grey. There are no 50 Shades with us.
No, 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 not at all. 50 Shades of Trope? Not at all.
Yowza.
Utopia or dystropia?
Okay.
Yeah. Trope and glory or utterly tropeless?
Oof. Yeah. A load of trope. That was meant to be tripe, but didn't really work.
Okay.
Let's pretend that didn't happen.
Yeah.
God bless editing. Without further ado, we should probably build up to what it is we're going to be reviewing, right?
Yeah, so I thought this week, just to kick us off...
This is your choice.
This is my choice.
This is what you've thrown into the ring as for our pilot episode.
For our pilot episode, it is an absolute classic. It is one of the best films of all time.
Whoa!
In my opinion.
Easy there.
I went there. I said it.
I mean, landmark of cinema is one thing, but yowza, you've gone big.
Yeah, and I'll tell you for why, Chris, because it is a film that really put film on the map for me.
Okay.
It covers all bases.
This is kind of like your like backstory on X Factor, isn't it? Like the piano is tinkling away and you sort of, this is big.
Yeah, this is the greatest stories playing in the background.
Yeah.
Talking about my family, my background, where I come from. And this is very important in terms of that because I actually went to see this film with three separate generations.
At the Pictures?
On my family. Yeah, at the Pictures. Of old as well. None of this streaming business.
So, of the family, we're talking yourself, your parentals.
Yeah.
And grandparents?
Grandparents as well.
Three generation of Carlberg.
I don't know why they were there, but it's one of those kind of...
Perfect storms.
Perfect storms, zeitgeist moments of this film has to be seen.
Okay. As an event.
As an event, yeah. It was the film event of the year. Or a film event 65 million years in the making.
Ooh.
It's a bit of a clue to what we're talking about here. So, have you got any ideas of what we are talking about today? Or any clues for the dear listener?
I do feel it's important at this stage we should probably do like a spoiler alert.
Okay.
We're going to be massive spoilers. Like, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen the film, once we tell you what it is, you probably should, like, stop listening and go and watch it first.
Just go. Get
we're going to ruin it. In fact, we're probably going to ruin lots of things, not even limited to this movie, because there's going to be some waffle and ramble chat and tangents. I'm the captain of the tangent.
Captain Tangent?
Captain Tangent.
Yeah, and his colours to the
mask. It's what I've got. That and trivia, people.
Okay, yeah. So that's a double-edged sword there, isn't it? Tangents and trivia.
Yeah, you don't get one without the other. I'm going to throw some trivia shots at you and we're going to tumble down the rabbit hole through the looking glass, my friend.
Okay, and I'm going to be...
You're going to have to be our lighthouse here.
The lighthouse of Segway.
You're going to have to moor us or take us back on the path.
Okay, I'll rise to that challenge. Clues then, Chris. What are we talking about?
It was 65 million years in the making, am I right?
Right.
This film broke all box office records at the time of its release. How about that?
That is huge.
Yeah?
That is absolutely huge.
It's directed by a certain Señor Spielberg.
Okay, okay.
Of E.T. and Jaws. Did he do Jaws?
Yeah, I believe he did, yeah.
Oh, man, I love Jaws. Carrying on.
Another big monster movie.
Indeed.
Which is, of course, another clue. And... It came out in
1993. How old were you in 1993, Jim?
I was about 10 or 11.
I think I was 11. Wait. Yeah, I was 9. I'm older than you. That doesn't make sense. I was 9. Am I older than you?
I don't know.
I was born in 1984.
You're definitely older than me.
Okay, cool.
So I'm much younger.
Yeah. I was 9.
So I was 7 years old. And it had a massive impact on me, this movie. And like I said, it was the film that dragged me back into the cinemas for other film events thereafter. And I'm of course talking about 1993's...
Seminal.
What, action.
In the way that blockbusters aren't a thing so much anymore.
Absolutely. Jurassic Park. JP.
I'm going to stop there.
Brilliant.
Jurassic Park, baby.
Jurassic Park. Alan Partridge, fame, Jurassic Park. What's your experience of this film? Talk to...
Well, so my first exposure to this film, didn't see it in the cinema, didn't go with a fam-a-lam.
Really?
No. First film I went to see was with my mum. We saw Snow White, bizarrely. I was 3. I didn't really enjoy it. Anyway. So my first exposure to Jurassic Park, I think, was at school. And one of the teachers, I think, must have rented it from Blockbuster or something like that. And it was when we were doing our Christmas school play, the one that all the parents are subjected to go and watch and wish they didn't have to, and then tell you it's brilliant and that you were brilliant, even if you weren't. And before we got called to do our little number or whatever in our class, we were watching Jurassic Park on a VHS in 4x3, in grainy, beautiful quality. And, yeah, it was big. It was an event. It was a big thing, and it's a great film. And I mean, I watched it last weekend as research for this, and I hadn't seen it in yonks, and it's really stood up. It's a lot better than I remember. Not that I remember it being bad. It's just a really great film. I mean, I wouldn't put it in my top 10, personally. I know that might be sacrilege for you. I'm sure it has a prominent role in your top 10.
Well, this film came at a stage in my life where I'd read all the books, I'd learnt all the names of the dinosaurs.
I might have to quiz you on those.
In the film. Oh, please do. Please do.
Okay.
Come at me, bro.
Oh, I'll come at you.
It was huge. It was a huge film. It opened my eyes to what could be done on screen in terms of cinema. It was an experience of going along with my entire family and everyone there having an opinion and comment and reaction to the film. My dad, for instance, he reacted completely differently to my grandparents,
okay,
who were looking on in horror at some of the things that were going on.
Probably overwhelmed and worried that the dinosaur might come out of the screen and eat them.
Indeed, yeah. They were a bit more of the sort of Casablanca era.
A bit flatter.
A bit flatter, yeah.
And your dad was...
He was laughing his head off at many of the violent moments in this. So it was
like audibly.
Audibly.
He was that guy in the cinema.
The lone guy in the cinema laughing his head off.
Guffawing or chortling.
Chortling at people getting chomped by giant lizards.
Giant terrible lizards.
Right, so a little bit of housekeeping. Some profanity might sneak into this. I'm known to have a bit of a potty mouth. I might drop some bombs. If anyone is of a nervous disposition or doesn't like swearing, soz, apologies, it's going to happen. Try to keep it highbrow, obviously. But, yeah.
Probably not best to have this on next to CBeebies.
Probably not, no. I'm going for an older demographic. But we don't rule anyone out, you know, we're inclusive.
Yeah, we do a range of films, probably, of, you know, a Well Done You to an 18, perhaps, or an X in Old Money.
Oof, spicy.
Yeah. Yeah, there may be a bit of language. And whilst we're holding our hands up here...
Jim has his hands in the air. Mine are at my sides.
Radio Gold. We did have some technical issues, so if the sound is different...
Full disclosure.
At this point...
Yeah, we had a moment. We got about an hour into the podcast. It was going grand, and then we had some technical gremlins, and Jim rather abruptly decided to call time on it. Stay tuned to the end, and you can actually hear Jim giving up on the podcast.
Yeah, I actually had a bit of an episode.
He had a bit of a tizzy.
He just
wasn't feeling it.
I did get in a slight sort of T-Rex level rage.
Yeah, I got the glue out and I'm still repairing the fence.
The electric fence.
Yeah.
And your stripy safari vehicle.
Okay, it's too soon to talk about that.
Okay.
So we reconvened a few weeks later, once Jim has actually calmed down. This has prompted us to have a secondary recording device. So, all goes well, touch wood. Hopefully we won't have any more mishaps.
Fail to plan to fail.
Exactly.
And that's what the characters of this film probably should have learnt.
Ooh, segue.
Excellent segue. We're
back on track.
We're back. We're back, baby.
The lighthouse has murdered us once more.
Okay, so we're going to talk cast. Who's in this film, Chris?
Who isn't in this film? Lots of people. Obviously, that was a stupid thing to say. But Sam Neill, is he Australian?
He is Australian. He's recently been an Irishman in Peaky Blinders.
Yeah, yeah. That's Northern Irish as well. That's a tricky accent to pull off, but I thought he did well, old Limpy.
Yeah. The Gaunts.
Yes. Yeah, apologies for all accents that follow. Like, on my part, at least, they're going to be horrendous. So Sam Neill, I'm getting him mixed up with Hugo Weaver. They do look a little bit alike.
Both Australian.
Both Australian. Massive sweeping generalisation stereotypes there. So he is playing Dr. Alan Grant, chief child hater and dinosaur expert extraordinaire.
Yeah, he's probably he's the snark, isn't he? The snarky character.
He is.
To start with.
He's a bit of a grumble chops, but a very knowledgeable and necessary anti-hero, I might call him.
An anti-hero, yeah. He's not a do-gooder.
He's not your archetypal hero, is he? He's not like Harrison Ford in any of the Indiana Jones films. He's like a reluctant hero.
Yeah, he's got the fedora. So that's a little hint. But
does he wear a fedora?
You know, he doesn't have a whip, and he has a lot of brushes, a series of brushes, and a velociraptor claw which he carries around. But paleontologists don't need bull whips in the same way.
Not like archaeologists.
No, indeed. You know, different ball game.
So then we've got a love interest. His love interest.
Dr. Laura Dern. Yes. Yeah. Dr. Ellie Sadler.
Is it made explicit there in item? I'm not so sure.
She wears pink.
Does that signify anything?
Yeah, she wears pink and ties a shirt in a knot.
That is, I don't know where you're going with that, but...
Well, she signifies she's a girl. Dr. Alan Grant's in blue.
Oh, I see what you've done here.
It's the 1990s, people.
Right, we're visually identifying and tying them together.
Yep.
She also rocks a pair of shorts, rather fetchingly, I would say. I'd go so far as to credit her with that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a crush growing up. You know, when you come back to this as a teen, after you've seen it when you're 7 years old.
I see what you did here.
You come back and you see Dr. Sadler in a new light.
We could do a whole segment on childhood crushes and how they might have affected us growing up.
That's a future pod.
I think so.
In the making. So we've got our arguable anti-hero and love interest.
Indeed.
We start out with them, don't we? And then we're taken to the park itself,
mm-hmm.
in which we meet several more characters, including, right, we're going to have quite a sizable...
Are we having a build-up here?
Build-up to...
I'm not really sure which character we're building up to here.
Well, I'm saying...
The one I want to build up to or the other one?
The one you definitely want to build up to.
Oh my God. I mean, I get flustered. I'm excited. You don't look excited, but I'll be excited for both of us.
I'm just building up to a tangent warning here.
Oh, hello.
Dr. Ian Malcolm's character, played by...
Oh, the one and only Jeff Goldblum. Actor, jazz musician, all-round great guy.
Raconteur.
Love interest, heartthrob. Has anyone ever outrageously managed to pull off wearing, exposing so much torso in a film?
It is, you know, even the most red-blooded male will get hot under the collar. Oof. At that point. We'll post the gif as well. There's an outstanding gif.
It really is. You showed me that last time around, pre-hissy fit, and it had me chuckling.
Yeah, it actually brought me back, that, from from the edge.
From the precipice.
Yeah. Okay, so Dr. Ian Malcolm.
Ooh, I got a little, since you touched on clothing. So, Jeff Goldblum's character explains that he only wears black and grey to avoid wasting time thinking about what to wear. And that is consistent in both Jurassic Park and The Fly. So there you go. And Michael Crichton, who wrote the book, put him in black as a bit of a sort of bad boy anti-hero. And then the next character who we might unveil wears white to sort of signify the other side of things.
I know I mentioned that kind of by accident, the blue and the pink, and then you've got white and the black,
mm-hmm.
Of Dr. Ian Malcolm. Yeah, just to carry on with the Goldblum, loving. You know, he's one of my favourite characters throughout the series. He actually goes on into the next film, and has quite a drastic change of character, weirdly. But in this film, he calls himself a chaos expert.
He does, yes. Just to pick up on something there, when you say one of, you do actually mean he is your favourite, right?
Are you including the dinosaurs in this as well? Because
for the purposes of my argument, no.
As much as Goldblum Park would be an excellent addition to the
season ticket holder.
Well, to the franchise, then I think the dinosaurs have a say in this, but we'll come to them a little bit later.
Okay.
But we've got Dr. Ian Malcolm as a chaos expert, and I guess in a way that kind of foreshadows some of the things that are going to happen.
Indeed. Some good foreshadowing. I do have a tangent for you, though. You know, I love a factoid, so here we go.
Tangent from the tangent.
Strap in, kids, this goes meta. Deep. So, Jeff Goldblum's character confuses chaos theory with Murphy's Law.
Explain.
I will. Thanks for asking. So, chaos theory is when the present determines the future, but the approximate present does not approximately determine the future. Unpick that one, if you will.
I've gone cross-eyed, dear listener.
He actually seemed to have a little bit of blood coming out of his nostril. He's hemorrhaging. But what Dr. Malcolm appears to state is life will always find a way, is closer to Murphy's Law, in that anything that can go wrong will go wrong.
Oh, interesting. So life finds a way. being one of the
key messages
from this film, and the messing with the forces of nature.
Mm.
Yeah.
Can I also add that I think we've done a spoiler alert, but can I also just say I'm probably going to be the fun police in all of this, you know, debunking and just ruining things.
Okay. Thanks for the disclaimer, officer.
You're welcome.
Some interesting facts there about Dr. Malcolm and Jeff Goldblum's character. There'll be plenty of Goldblum chat going forward.
Just wait.
That chest.
Oh, sir. That waxed torso. Scantily unclad.
It's the Winslet pose as well. The draw me like one of your French girls pose.
Back arched. No real reason for him to have his shirt undone. But
this is pre-Winslet as well. She clearly took inspiration.
Yeah, he invented that look. He made it his own.
Almost as esteemed as the good Dr. Malcolm.
Indeed.
And Dr. Goldblum, let's call him. That's, you know.
Going forwards, I'm not going to call him by, like, acting, screen character name. That's the one I want. No, he's Jeff Goldblum.
He's just the Goldblum.
Pure
okay.
And simple. I mean, I'm not very good with names, so, yeah, we're going to have to identify people by the things I remember them by.
Dr. Goldblum, black shirt.
Exactly. Exposed torso man.
We might have to do this with the dinosaurs as well, just so we're sure of what we're talking about. But linking on from the black, we had to talk about the white side,
the light side, a man who had not appeared in a movie since 1983, had been on a 15-year hiatus, came back for this one, a man who's starred in such epics as, insert films here,
Great Escape. Was
Great Escape. Oh, he was the chap on the bus, wasn't he? Almost made it and then got tripped up by the German officer saying something to him in English. Or good luck or something.
Good luck.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks. Then a sort of rabbit in the headlight sort of like, oh no, I'm dead.
Yeah, we'll have to get that one out at Christmas. That's a bit of a Christmas classic.
Oh, so good. Yeah, the one and only Richard Attenborough.
Richard Attenborough. Not to be confused with...
David. No, what was that?
David.
That was Michael Caine.
We're not
only 16 years old.
What? It's not Dead Ringers.
No.
We're here to talk Dickie Attenborough. I've got an impression of him because you can't talk about Jurassic Park without doing the initial line. We had a classic version of John Williams' theme tune earlier from yourself. So can we have that again?
What, you want an intro?
Yeah, yeah, I want to do a build-up for this line.
Okay,
here we go. Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Bit Mandela there, mate.
Well, you know, was he released at this point in 1993?
Potentially. I mean, isn't it 1994 where Invictus is set? I think it is. I might have made that up. We might have to fact check that.
Okay, so we'll avoid the Mandela crossover with Richard Attenborough. Let's focus. We're going on tangents again.
No.
Let's talk about Richard Attenborough. 15 years since he'd made a...
15-year hiatus, yeah.
And what a comeback in this film.
What a comeback. He's like the granddad everybody wishes they had. He's like... this kind of eccentric British philanthropist in a rather fetching man from Del Monte white suit. And a cane. Has he got a cane?
He does. He has it with the amber.
Yes.
He has a piece of amber.
The only thing I think missing is if he actually hit someone with the cane. Like, you know Rafiki in Lion King, like, hit twacks Simba on the head to try and help him remember who he is. I feel like there's just missing a trick there. Or it should have a sword in it. I don't know. I just feel like a cane was an
ooh, sword cane.
Yeah, like an underused prop. Well, yeah, I had a mosquito in amber in it, but...
Pfft. Yeah, yeah. So that's probably more relevant because that will come back to the science of the actual thing a little bit later.
We'll be touching on science.
Because that's a big element of the tropes in this movie. But with John Hammond, having read small bits of the book... I remember taking it into school whilst everyone else was reading Goodnight, Mr. Tom.
There were you with JP.
You know, talking, you know, reading out JP, you know, eviscerations going on all throughout. And it quickly got confiscated.
What, the book?
The book did, yeah. Literature in a school. Confiscated.
Outrageous. How many editions or copies of Jurassic Park do you think you've gone through? Or did you get it back?
I got it back.
Oh, right.
I got it back. But coming back to Sir Dickie's character,
mm-hmm.
He's actually quite villainous in the book, where he's presented as a shining...
A beacon, almost.
Dad's doorstep challenge granddad.
Nice.
In this... Yeah, thanks. In this one. So he's presented as a... In a similar way, he's a guy who doesn't have control of what he's supposed to control.
No, not at all.
Yet he's got a heart of gold. Yeah.
You dish out the Werther's originals and you guzzle them with glee.
Another missed opportunity, I feel. We've got other cast members as well. We've got Bob Peck as Robert Muldoon.
Muldoon.
Who is not Scottish. He's quite a posh outback type, isn't he? A big game.
Is he meant to be a Saffa?
What's that?
South African.
Oh, right.
I hope that's not derogatory. Apologies to all of our Southern African listeners, if we have any.
You bloody Saffa.
Oh, you've done it now.
No. So Bob Peck as Robert Muldoon, as a big game. He's kind of the expert on the dinosaurs.
He's like their keeper, isn't he?
Yeah, the park ranger.
That just makes me think of Yogi Bear. Can I just highlight who I didn't even realise was in it until I rewatched it? An intense chain smoking performance from Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah, it's one of his understated performances, isn't it? As Ray Arnold, Mr. Ray, hold on to your butts. Arnold. One of my favourite lines in the film.
That is a great line. I just couldn't get past how he chuffed so many cigarettes, like constantly chuffing. Like, that's something you don't really see in movies so much. It's almost like they don't want you to see smoking anymore. But he was the Marlboro man in that film. He was like Norman Nicotine. He was absolutely putting them away like no one's business, whilst also being charismatic and really hogging a lot of screen time there. And speaking of screen time and Samuel L. Jackson, I'm going to throw in a cheeky little Easter egg here. My research has turned up that there's a point at the beginning where they look at... he's sat in front of his computer screen. Now, eagle-eyed people, if you were to zoom in, you will see a still frame of Rob Schneider from the movie Jaws, one of Spielberg's earlier classics.
Not Deuce Bigelow. Roy Schneider.
Did I say the Rob Schneider?
Rob Schneider, yeah.
Oh. Rob Schneider. All right, my bad.
Brilliant.
That was almost a good link.
I'm keeping the Rob Schneider in. So you mean Roy Schneider?
I mean Roy Schneider, the very same, yeah. From Jaws. Yeah, his Fizzog is on the screen. So yeah, a little cheeky Easter egg for all you Easter egg fans out there.
Trivia and Easter eggs.
Oh, come with the Easter bunny.
I will. I'll hold you to that.
All right, sick. I've got another few.
Go for it.
No, I'll come back to them.
Oh.
I'm not dishing out the eggs. This is an egg hunt, mate.
Okay. Yes, quite right. You know, tickle the balls a little. Tease. Leave them wanting more.
That's it. That's staying in the edit.
Okay, and we've also got, of course, if we're going to go the wider cast, we've got Wayne Knight as Dennis Nedry.
Fat guy from Third Rock from the Sun. And Seinfeld.
I suppose he's the closest we've got to a human antagonist in this film.
Well, as in he's kind of like a flawed guy who does wrong.
He's a
kind of lovable.
Greedy corporate...
Sellout. Scientist.
Yeah, guy, yeah.
Who's staring type 2 diabetes square in the face.
Yeah, that it's a surprise that doesn't get him before the actual dinosaur.
Seriously, man, he's a Snickers pie away from losing a foot to diabetes.
This is interesting. I mean, we've got the dinosaurs themselves.
Mm.
Do you know any of the dinosaurs that are in this film?
I'm aware of a handful of them. I mean... But you're the dino guy. You're the dino expert.
I am the closest thing to a paleontologist on this podcast.
That I've ever met. I mean, I can name dinosaurs, whether or they're not in the film. I don't know. I might make myself look foolish. I think this is a game for you.
Well, little known secret, way back when, I once went on a year six trip to the Blue John Caves in Castleton. And let me tell you.
Is that in the north?
That is in the north.
Okay.
Yeah, north of Watford Gap. So you won't know much about that.
No, we don't have a clue. Is that Midland North?
Beyond the
north
wall. North. It's Derbyshire. So what you got there is you've got the Peak District and lots of fossils. Okay. Yeah, lots of natural fossils there. And I was spotting them like there was no tomorrow, right?
Okay.
You know, I was, nothing interesting, but it was just little things like ferns and leaves. I was looking for dinosaurs, but, you know, that comes in with the paleontology career later.
Mm.
So ultimately, I never went down that route, but because of my experience, I am the closest thing we've got to a qualified paleontologist.
Right. Here. I mean, that combined with your JP book thing, I mean, were you a lonely child? I'm playing. So, name those dinosaurs. How many dinosaurs do you think you can name in that feature in Jurassic Park? I've got a list of them here.
Okay, so what are we talking in number?
I don't know, you tell me.
In this film. So we have the T-Rex.
Big angry guy with small arms.
Yeah, who I believe is female in this film.
Oh, they're all supposed to be female, aren't they? That's where it all goes peaked on.
Okay, yeah, cool. We'll come to the science of the thing a little bit later.
That's our science segment.
Yeah. So look out for that. You know, paleontology, science, we cover the lot.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got the T-Rex, which has a very significant role in the film. We also have the non-human villains, I guess, in the Velociraptors.
Yeah.
And we've also got a little bit more obscure. We've got the Dilophosaurus.
What's that?
That is the daffodil head fishgill Asaurus.
Spitty daffodil kills fat man.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for ease of use, we will go Spitty Daffodil. From this point forward. We've got the Triceratops, which features very, very briefly.
Kind of like a chunky rhino.
Yeah, the chunky... Chunky three-horned rhino man.
Yep.
And
absolute unit.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't get used very much.
No. Underutilized, I feel.
But
it's got real range.
One of the best Goldblum lines comes from that. Encounter.
Is that the poop scene?
The big poop joke.
Oh. Yeah.
That's a big pile of shit, he says.
Strong. I mean, I could just throw out some dinosaur names. I have no idea if they feature. There's like long neck guy who sneezes on them.
Ah, the Brachiosaur.
Sneezy long neck.
Sneezy long neck. Yeah, good.
Yep.
Got that covered.
Stegosaurus. Is he in there? I don't know. He's like spiky spine guy.
There's a scene where there's a collection of them by the lake where the... I wouldn't ask you to do it again, but the John Williams theme kicks in.
If you've got it in the can, you can use that as many times. You can underscore this whole podcast with that now.
I'll hold you to that in part. And there's the... When, quite famously GIFed these days, the scene where Dr. Grant sees the dinosaurs for the first time and you have the, welcome. How was that? Was that to Mandela?
Still a hint of Mandela.
I'll work on it. We have the scene where there's a whole group of dinosaurs and then you have the Brachiosaurs out, but you also have the sneezy long necks.
Yep.
And you also have the Parasaurolophus.
Crumbs, what was that? Well done.
They are...
Is that a Greek guy?
Long trumpet heads.
Long trumpet heads. I just had a thought. What's a collective noun for a group of dinosaurs? Does one exist?
Excellent question.
And does it vary dinosaur to dinosaur?
Parasaurolophy? Who knows? Dear listener, let us know.
If any like science buffs or people who know more than Jim about dinosaurs, I'm not sure they exist, personally. But if you believe you are in that very niche, narrow band of human, let us know. I'd love to know.
Yeah, please do. Please do. So that's the dinosaurs covered. We will go into it with the tropes a little bit more as we go. Before we get on to the tropes themselves, you said about minutes of screen time.
Aha, yes. Now, Jurassic Park, big old movie, cost $63 million to make, which at the time wasn't the biggest grosser. That'd be spender. Terminator 2 cost a princely $102 million. So really, Jurassic Park was a snip. Yet it went on to gross $1 billion back in 1993. That's mad. But for all of that money, because there's a lot spent on animatronics, I think there's some computer-generated graphics going on there, some really amazing special effects stuff. For a film with a runtime of 2 hours and 7 minutes, Jim Carberg, can you tell me how many minutes of screen time the dinosaurs have combined in total?
I'm going to say under 20 minutes.
Okay, strong. I mean, I'm calling that a guess.
That's a guess.
That's guess A.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How many have I got?
You've got two more. It's like baseball. Or right. Rounders. I think you get three in rounders.
Yeah, yeah. 15 minutes.
Christ on a bike, he's nailed it.
Home run, guys.
I mean, you know, we could have hammed that up for the podcast. I'm like, oh no, that's not right. Oh no, he's straight in there for 15 minutes.
I'm a paleontologist. What can I say?
Yeah, fair enough. But, you know, it didn't create great drama.
To be continued. Coming soon on Trope Stormers.
It was a turkey-sized elephant in the room and we failed.
Saw yourself and then run would be my advice. Don't mention his little arms.
Yeah, oh, he hates that. Don't challenge him to a game of pool. He won't be happy.